Accession number 23329, reel 18.
Mr. Kaljunga, reel 18.
Okay. When we stopped at Stargard, we saw literally hundreds of girls in the uniforms of the Hitler Märchen. Not sure if I've got the pronunciation right, but anyway. Strength through joy was the motto of young Germany, and until they saw us, these girls did look strong and joyous. But when they saw us, the transformation was quite startling. Their faces were flushed, and they hissed and spat, and they just tried to communicate their loathing of us. Natural enough, I suppose, to hold the enemy in contempt, but this was an extraordinary exhibition, and one felt that the evil which had been inculcated in them since their early childhood had transcended the natural grace of youth. At night, we lay like crabs in a crate, each man pinioned by his neighbours, and beneath us just the hard boards of the truck. Any attempt to move brought cries of protest from people whom you flailed or got into a headlock or something, and the drafts whipped in from the gaps between the boards, and it was, as I say, pretty wretched. One man did manage to escape the crowd. He made himself a hammock from a blanket, and so he swung above us happily until eventually the hammock broke. The next day, four of us at a time were allowed to sit in the guard section of the truck. It got them into trouble, and in fact we had three sets of sentries relieved of their duty in our truck. But finally Oberfeldwebel, it's a sergeant, was put in charge of us. He was a friendly soul, very proud of his Africa Corps ribbon. If he was expected to tighten things up, he didn't. He allowed us to take it in turns in the guard section of the truck, and in fact on the second night even allowed two prisoners from each cage, that was four prisoners, to sleep there, which did make conditions a little more pleasant for the others. It was good to feel that here was somebody who had a streak of kindness in him, and we respected him. We didn't think he was weak. Our feelings of good fellowship were rather dissipated in the late afternoon. We had a lot of people suffering from dysentery, and the train was stopping fairly frequently. Eventually we were told that this would be the last opportunity to leave the trucks for some time, and it was then we found that we'd stopped in the centre of a village, and the main street was running alongside the railway line. Almost as if there'd been forewarning, the populace was gathered there, and we were allowed only on the street side of the track, not on the far side of the train. And the watching villagers were more than amused. They cheered relentlessly as men relieved themselves. During the night we reached Soltau, and we spent many hours in the siding there, partly I think because our bomber stream was targeting Hanover, which wasn't too far away. We could see the flushed sky, and we could hear the rumble of the bombs. Somehow the hostility of the villagers seemed no longer unprovoked. To them we were Terrorfliegers, Luftgangsters. All right, we were powerless now, but we were the forerunners of the nightly hordes which were flying over Germany and destroying its cities. Arrived at Fallingbostel in the morning. We marched in parties of 200 over the cobbles of a narrow street, stoned often as we marched, but soon we were in the country again, and somehow the rural pattern of Western Europe was quite different from those plains of Poland. Moreover, we were in our own theatre of war, and in Normandy the Germans were retreating, because we were absolutely avid for news. The canary hadn't sung for a couple of days, but it was quite safe in a model racing car that Bristow had made. Its engine was to scale, it was perfect in every detail. It may have been a bit of a risk to hide it in such a beautiful model, because some German might very well have taken a fancy to it and removed it, and he would have got quite a surprise when he found what else was in it. It was a 6 kilometer march to the camp, and halfway we rested outside the barracks of SS Panzer Regiment. The young men with their death's head emblem were gathered there to stare at us, just with not hatred, just a mixture of complacency and almost sympathy. There were dispatch riders sweeping down the road, and flinging themselves into the barracks, and obviously trying to impress the shabby ranks of their enemy prisoners. One overdid it and had a fall. We jeered at him, and the young Germans then became threatening, and the officer in charge very quickly gave us the order to march. We passed Stalag 11B, also at Fallingbostel, very large prison camp. There were French prisoners on the other side of the wire watching us. They looked rather poker-faced. We got to our camp, which was labelled 355, but as I mentioned earlier, we retained the Thorn number of 357. As we marched into the De Lhasa, men from the earlier parties shouted advice about the methods of the German searches. Our clothes were baked in the De Lhasa, and we had a hot shower operated by a squat Russian who had a huge downturned moustache. He looked rather like Stalin and immediately was christened Joe. He wouldn't talk, not then anyway. Later we did learn that he was a Ukrainian farmer. He'd never been in the forces, but had been taken prisoner by the Germans nevertheless. When I got to the search table, I had an argument with the German searchers because I had a copy of Richard Hillary's The Last Enemy, which of course was death, but the Germans, recognizing the word enemy, imagined that the book was disparaging of them, or maybe that it glorified the British. And in spite of my explanation, they didn't seem to understand that the sleep that I was signaling in sign language was death. Another German, overhearing the argument, read the quotation which Hillary took the title from which Hillary took the title and handed the book back. The search was finished. We were assembled for a pep talk by a German officer. Dixie managed to warn us that the officer's grip of the English language wasn't all that secure, but that he hadn't liked the laughter which he'd got from earlier parties. Ordinarily, we accepted mistakes when Germans spoke only halting English, as they accepted our attempts to communicate in German. But this man had a comic delivery and an absolutely reckless confidence in his ability. The tight regulations posted in the huts appeared to have been his doing. Under the heading Air Raids, we were told that should a high explosive bomb fall into any billet, prisoners therein must evacuate with immediate effect. Only eight of the men in D5 at Heiderkrug still remained together. New quarters were not very good. They were long, low barracks, grey brick, and they'd been built by forced Italian labour. The floors were well below ground level. The windows were small and square, and there were only four. There were 72 men in each room, and a small night latrine was fitted with a concrete trough and a tiny flushing system. We hadn't had one of those, tiny or otherwise. The floors were damp, rough stone. For each eight men, there was a long trestle table and two forms, so the eight of us formed one section. We were two combines of four, Toby, Dick, Ron Kennett and myself in the one, and in the other, three Australians, Buck Buchanan, Alan Scanlon and Pouchy Davies. They'd never been separated, those three, since Manchester had been ditched in the North Sea. The fourth member of their party was a French-Canadian, Junior Gautier. When there was food to cook, we cooked together, and the stooge work was performed, one from each combine, on a weekly basis. Our bread ration was 1/7 of a loaf per man per day. Buck used to cut three or four slices from each 1/7, but Toby had a very sharp knife which he guarded very jealously, and he obtained 7 wafers from each of our rations. Throughout the camp, some method involving chance was employed to ensure that there was no favouring one rather than another in the apportioning of food. Belts were tight. Mine was drawn in 4 inches in the next few months. And in those circumstances, it was very easy to become obsessed with the idea that one had been done out of something. So if you drew cards or something like that, overcome our own frailty. The area of the camp was very large, possibly exceeding that of Thorn, the largest compound, C compound, comprised 6 barracks with washrooms at one end and 3 latrines. The latrines were 60 yards from the barracks, and they were divided into 2 sections, but the wall went only 2/3 of the way up. As time went on, the walls diminished. Bricks were appropriated for a variety of purposes, and as the draft became fiercer, Ron Mogg composed verses not fit to be recited here, exhorting prisoners to desist from this vandalism. Each section could have been described as a 48 holer. The holes were pretty crude, in long wooden platform. So when there was a full house, and there was usually a queue, there were 24 pairs sitting back to back. And beyond the latrines was the parade ground, and on the other side of the fence, which skirted that, there was the inevitable belt of conifers. Joining C compound on one side was R compound, and on the other, the very small D compound, which was never used. There was a promise that we could convert one of the two barracks into a theatre, but it was never fulfilled. And then these compounds all opened onto a large central area known as the main compound. And on the far side of that, there were 2 more compounds, A and B. In the main compound, there were a number of wooden huts. They accommodated the domestic administration and the library, and later on more prisoners. There were 4 cookhouses, a fuel store, and sundry other business buildings used for the most part by the Germans themselves. The rest of the compound was open country, too rough for playing pitches, but invaluable for less active recreation. Probably our compound had been intended to accommodate German personnel, because the barracks were of wooden construction. They were smaller, roomier, and better lighted. But anyway, it was occupied by army prisoners who also had B-lager. The RAF went into C-lager. For the first few weeks, we were locked in our respective compounds. There was still a lot of timber lying about, and the Germans knew from experience that the Krieges regarded timber as legitimate booty. Our first excursion into the open country of the camp arose from the still unsolved puzzle of the 3 superfluous prisoners. To save trouble, Dixie had given the answer to the German authorities, but they refused to be convinced that they'd made so simple an error, and they wanted a full-scale count. Well, it wasn't very often that the 8,000 or so prisoners were massed together on one parade. It was a very sobering sight, so much manpower here serving not much purpose. Every man had his story. Many had families wiped out by German retribution fire, the V2s, V1s probably at that time. Homes, businesses lost, friends and brothers dying in the fighting. Some in Japanese prison camps. There were the Dear John letters, the defections of wives, increasing in number all the time as the years passed. Peter Thomas, a law student at that time, but later member of the Heath Cabinet and now Lord Thomas of Gwydir, believed that the ever-growing number of divorces lowered the morale of the camp. People were using him not exactly to represent them, but to put their case to the authorities at home. In his 3.5 years as a prisoner, Peter assisted on average 4 men each week to prepare affidavits, which Dixie Deans was empowered to swear. These were cases mainly brought against wives. So men brooded and pitied themselves in the darkness, or they wrapped themselves up in blankets and slept away the day. There was very little laughter at that time. In the ensuing months, what comedy there was usually stemmed from the fight for firewood, and all our shortages it took difficulties to bring back the laughter, strangely. We laughed at ourselves, but we also laughed at the Germans when we managed to outwit them. Back to the parade of all the men in the camp, over 8,000, soon to be more than 10,000. We knew that we were in for a prolonged counting session, but there was a lot of timber about, and that put us in very good humour. We didn't at that time have access to this part of the camp, so there weren't any guards in the corner boxes. The ground was rough, the grass was up to our knees, and in those conditions 8,000 men could camouflage a fair amount of mischief. Stacked against the fence were the cage frames from the cattle trucks, no doubt ready for use again, or perhaps for dismantling. We decided dismantling was the better of the alternatives. The wire was wrenched away and the frames were broken apart. Other bits of timber were also pinched, and 72 men from one hut hauled away an electric light pole, which presumably had been one too many when the camp was built. While they were counted, the pole lay in the long grass between the ranks, and 6 hours later, when the Germans acknowledged that the three extra men were indeed the Heidegrud escapers, and were so pleased to have the rolls in order again, that they were rather less thorough than usual in superintending our return to the compounds. The pole was carried by the 72 Kriegers, marching in tight formation safely to the hut. Other squads helped to screen them, created light-hearted diversions, and eventually all the timber lying about the camp that hadn't been taken on that day was collected by Russian prisoners and stacked in D compound. And once that had been done, the rest of the camp was thrown open to us. But as a precaution against prisoners entering D compound by way of picking the lock, a guard was stationed at the gate, but a new lock might have been more effectual, because a bit of skillful questioning drew from him the belief that he was there to prevent us from escaping. It hadn't been explained to him that his prime responsibility was the timber. We were able to convince him that the timber was ours. People quoted imaginary clauses of the Geneva Convention, and it was suggested to him that he allow us to enter the compound in parties of six. So the sentry allowed in six prisoners, and relocked the gate and conducted them to the heap of timber. They suggested that it would be quicker if they passed the timber through the fence to their friends. In that way, he'd only have to let one party of six into the compound. So the sentry not only agreed, but he helped in the work, and the timber stack diminished rapidly. So this was the position when the Feldwebel, who posted the sentry in the first place, appeared. And first to see him were the Kriegis, who politely thanked the guard and departed with as much timber as they could carry. Feldwebel began to pursue first one prisoner and then another. But in fact, he didn't manage to catch up with anybody.